This is Talk Is Cheap on KPWLP 97.3 FM, Eugene Peaceworks Independent Community Radio. Okay, this week I'm just going to play you this piece that I found that fairly well explains how banks, especially central banks, create wars, and how especially the U.S. Petrodollar has exploited countries and caused death and destruction everywhere, and that's why they came up with the BRICS. That's why these countries are trying to get off the dollar, and that was why we originally created cryptocurrency, was to get off the dollar with something that is not controlled, really, by anyone, a neutral currency. And unfortunately, that has not been the way cryptocurrency has worked, but that was its original intent, was to get off the petrodollar, and that's why other countries are trying to get off the petrodollar, because it's used to just exploit people, not benefit them. And in no way is this financial advice. Please see a financial advisor before making any investment decisions. So that's coming up here after I give you a little commentary that I do every few show. Every once in a while, I gotta blow off some steam here. So I just read this Michael Crichton book. So maybe you're familiar with Michael Crichton, of course, is the one who wrote Jurassic Park. I originally heard about him through, I remember Andromeda Strain when I was a kid, where there's a disease that turns your blood into sand. And I can still picture that scene in my mind where they cut open the body and the sand pours out of the body and everything. So Crichton, you know, Crichton, I mean, I used to call him Crichton, but I guess it's Michael Crichton. To me, he's kind of a bit of a hack, but Jeff Goldblum's line in Jurassic Park, which was written by Crichton, where he talks about, it's not that we could do it, it's that we should do it. Should we do it? It's not can we do it, it's should we do it. I don't know, that was pretty good for Crichton to do that. But he's way off base on his global warming position. Although he's saying to we should fund more science, and that I agree with. Kind of a mixed bag with Crichton, but so this is, you guys have probably heard of this, it's called State of Fear, and basically what it is it's kind of an apologist for claiming that global warming is not real, and a lot of the points he makes are true, that we definitely do need to change the way we fund our science development and things like that, and there should be much more neutral research. But there's a couple of statements in here that I've studied sustainable design for 30 years, and I've watched, S.I. Hayakawa in the 70s, we wanted to put a $2.50 tax on gasoline, because I lived through the gas crisis. I was a little kid when we were, you know, rationing gas. And if we'd have done that, we don't use whale oil anymore. This is called progress. That's why we're called progressives, I guess, is, you move on to different things. You don't just keep the same technology forever. And one of my spiel that I'm always making is, it's not about whether there's global warming or not, okay? And I'm sure you cannot dump a bunch of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere without changing something, but hear me now and listen to me later. Why would you buy all your electricity and all your energy from a central location when you literally have energy bombarding the planet so much so it causes lights in the sky, okay? And now hear me out. Now, Tesla is a kind of a mad scientist, but I can tell you from experience, not direct experience, but I know that they degauss electrical towers before they can work on them. They have to take the static charge away from these towers. So Tesla supposedly had a way of pulling energy static electricity right out of the sky. Now, if you had put some energy into developing that technology instead of nuclear energy, we might be able to decentralize, and in the areas that the sun doesn't shine that much, you could literally pull electricity out of the sky. And it's called capacitance, okay? I'm not an electrical engineer, and I don't play one on television. I'm not claiming to be an expert on this. I'm just giving you my own little experience here. Down the street, when I grew up, this guy, Ted, his name was Ted Crissell. He invented those little lights that you see that blink on the highway when there's construction. And the reason they blink, instead of staying on solid, is because they blink, and don't hold me to this, but they last, like the batteries last like 10 times as long because of capacitance. And I don't want to get into a long lecture on capacitance. I'm not an expert on electricity, but again, if you were to take a capacitor and hook it to one of these towers and the static electricity, it would build up in the capacitor. And when the voltage got to 12 volts or a voltage that we could use, it would then dissipate it into a battery. Okay, and these lights were the opposite of that direction. These lights that you see on the highway during construction that blink at you, those little orange lights. The reason that works is because the battery doesn't have to shoot out a constant voltage, and the battery can go lower. So the battery can go lower in capacity and still produce a charge because it's sending a small voltage out to that capacitor that is then collecting that charge until it's a higher voltage that it then can use. All right, and it's called it's the maker. I got to give the Makerspace credit here. In Eugene, because they told me what's called a jewel thief circuit, and it's J-O-U-L, that type of jewel, not jewel, a jewel thief circuit, because what I'm experimenting on here is you can actually get electricity out of wastewater, because there's bacteria in the water that create electricity, and again, it's a very, very low voltage that would then collect in a capacitor. All right, so I'm just saying, why would you pay huge amounts of money to run a wire to a central location? All right, so let me just read you this passage from the appendix of from the author's message in Michael Crichton's State of Fear. There are many reasons to shift away from fossil fuels, and we will do so in the next century without regulation, financial incentives, carbon conservation programs, or interminable yammering of fear mongers. So far as I know, nobody had to ban horse transport in the early 20th century. Well, first of all, actually they did have to ban horse transport because there was crap all over the streets and people were stepping in crap all the time. But so again, like what I'm saying, no. Now, I talked to a guy. I was working at KPFK in Los Angeles, and there was another volunteer there that had worked for the oil industry. Okay, kind of a conservative guy at the newsroom in KPFK. I only did it for about 9 months there. I'm not an expert ace reporter or anything. So what he claimed that there was no direct subsidy to oil companies. Okay, now that may or may not be true. Depends on what you call a subsidy. But I would say to you that every war in the 20th century has been fought over oil. So people have literally died. That's why they say there's blood for oil. So that is an indirect subsidy for oil companies. But trust me, we have subsidized the oil companies many, many, many times. So that is, or we would have been off in a true capitalist system, whether you believe in capitalism or not. In a true capitalist system, we would have been off oil long ago because no one would ever been allowed to get that big. In fact, that was why one of the reasons we had the Sherman antitrust laws to stop trusts like the oil companies, like Standard Oil, because Rockefeller ruthlessly cut his competitors out and was not using fair capitalist labor, fair capitalist practices in competition to gain a domination over the oil market. You can go into Ida Turnbull if you want to read about all the nefarious things that he did, and if you ever watch There Will Be Blood, that is based on Upton Sinclair's analysis of the oil industry. Admittedly leftist, but still relatively accurate, and historians would agree that there's no way that the oil companies, that we would have been off oil long ago if the government had, if we had a government that kept us from having monopolies. That it's a monopoly is the reason. And so we would have been off oil long ago. And the solar panels was invented in like 1898. We've had solar panels for long time, and electric cars for a long time. So not that, and again, we should be conserving electricity. So then Crichton goes on to say that, you know, even solar panels, and I can't find it in here again. I can't, it's a huge book and I'd have to go through the whole thing. But in a nutshell, what he said was, you know, if we it would take 27,000 solar panels to produce enough electricity to deal with the amount that we need right now, and it would be like the state of the entire eastern half of the United States would have to be covered in solar panels. Okay, so but let me put it to you this way: we look at all the roofs we have, all and the parking lots all over the place. If we covered all our rooftop solar, if we covered all our rooftops and parking lots with solar panels, we would have plenty of electricity, and with the grid that we already have existing, we would have plenty of electricity. And each of us, especially mostly, you could put these on your own house, so you would not have to depend on a centralized system, but it would be nice to use the grid that we already have. But again, if we could come up with other technologies easily for those areas that don't get sunlight, that would not be polluting. And we definitely don't want to do nuclear. You know, EWEB and them are still figuring they're going to put a nuclear power plant in Idaho and then run it across in a wire, again, all the way down to your house here in Eugene from Idaho, that you're going to pay for all that wire and for a nuclear power plant. And I can tell you, there's a lot of people that are not going to let that happen. So the U of O, I talked to this guy on the May 4th event downtown that the Neighborhood Anarchist Collective put on, the guy from the Climate Justice League. And apparently the U of O is not going to fix their boiler, and it's just going to stay a gas boiler. What they were going to do is put a giant electric boiler in there that for their heating system that would have required additional infrastructure all the way to Bonneville, and then probably, again, more infrastructure to, because they need a bigger wire to run more electricity down here for something like that. That's a huge amount of electricity to run an electric. Electric heaters use a lot of resistance. That's why you're getting heat in the wire, because it's causing resistance. It's literally slowing down the electricity, pushing in a smaller pipe and heating up that pipe is why that boiler takes so much electricity. So I looked it up. Like I say, I'm a sustainable designer. You know, the winter months are much longer here than the summer months. So solar is difficult to work with, but they could easily put solar panels on there, and you do what's called a networked heat pump. They can put heat pumps under the street and so those use much less energy because you're really just running a fan. And the other thing you can do is, and Oregon has already done studies on this. There's already a plan that was vetted for this. You can take a water tank on the top of a hill, and we have plenty of water here, and we need water storage for fires. And there's already these tanks sitting around, a lot of tanks sitting around abandoned that could still be used or refurbished. Put these on a hill, pump the water up there in the summertime with solar panels, and then let it drain down in the wintertime and run a turbine and get your energy there, combined with lower energy using heaters like heat pumps. And I'm sorry, but, you know, you might have to, like your grandfather told you, kids at that U of O, you might have to shut the light off and put on a sweater, too, which is going to be difficult. That's going to be a difficult thing to do, but, you know, you're going to have to do that. And the other thing that everybody's, just a funny story that I don't expect them to really do this, but, you know, I visited went to New Alchemy Institute back in the 90s, and which is a sustainability development center in Massachusetts, where it's very cold in the winter in Massachusetts. Lady was heating, down the street, was heating her greenhouse with Angora rabbits, okay, because rabbits have 108 degree body temperature, and then, so she would run tubes through the greenhouse, not pump air from the greenhouse into her house, but you run tubes through there, let the tubes heat the air and run it back into your house. And then, and this is 24/7, 365 days a year. And then you can they comb the rabbits for the angora and use the manure tea for fertilizer. And so you could have this at the U of O. Think about this, because you need to radically rethink the way this goes. But, you know, there's tunnels already underneath the U of O. Can you imagine if we filled those tunnels with angora rabbits and the husbandry class at the U of O, which I'm sure they have, that would be part of your class assignments. You have to take care of these rabbits and comb them, and you have school kids come in and work with the rabbits and let them out and stuff, and then comb them for the angora. And we can have green, yellow angora sweaters at the U of O for the games. So I know that's a far out concept, but you're going to have to think out of the box here. The Mall of America, which I believe is in Minnesota, where it's, again, even colder than Massachusetts, the entire Mall of America supposedly is heated by the body heat of its patrons. It does not have a heating system at all in the Mall of America. So that's my little rant for you this week. And then here coming up is how banks create wars, especially central banks. And Alexander Hamilton, you know, what's his name, didn't read. I've read that book that he read about Alexander Hamilton, and he didn't read the whole book, because Alexander Hamilton is pretty much facilitated. He was the one that wanted a central bank, partly to facilitate war, and also that facilitated slavery, too. So it's really ironic that Lin-Manuel Miranda, no disrespect to you guys, and I think Hamilton is great. The play is awesome, but you need to reread that book. And the guy that wrote that, I can't think of his name, but he is kind of a hack. I actually met him, Ron Chernow, because for this book signing of Alexander Hamilton. And I asked him, so has the central bank been justified? Is it justified that we had a central bank? And he just unequivocally said, oh, yeah, we would be a complete loss if we didn't have a central bank. Well, there's a lot of people that would disagree with that. So, he's a famous author, but he's kind of a centrist. And he's also someone that you would find, I don't know whether he used to work for the Wall Street Journal or whatever, but he's a conservative. Okay, so his books are pretty well written, but and like I say, if that's in the Hamilton book, that he started the central bank and was groomed by the wealthy people partly for that purpose. He was literally he was an immigrant, and he was groomed by wealthy people at the time. All right, so there I just had to get that out. And what else? Hopefully by your listening to this, we've ended all war, and the UN has a humanitarian force in Gaza giving out food. God. Hopefully Israel has admitted that they have nuclear weapons, and so Iran has decided not to pursue a nuclear power plan, a nuclear weapons plan. And the doomsday clock has moved back a few seconds. Thanks for listening. Tell your friends, support independent media. Like I say, coming up, how the central banks and the petrodollar exploits people and the environment. Thanks for listening. Tell your friends, support independent media. And as a reward for listening to my ranting, something only available here on KEPW. Surprise at the end for you. Thanks for listening. Tell your friends. Oh, and Gong is playing at the Wow Hall on June 16th, so I hope you'll see me there. Gong at the Wow Hall, June 16th. Not the original players, but still a fantastic band, mostly in the vein of the Pierre Morland's Gong, but they do play Master Builder and a few other tunes like that. Oh, and next week I will be telling you about the mushroom boycott, the windmill mushroom boycott. They want you to boycott Sunnyside mushrooms from Sunnyside, Washington. You can find more about that at the ufw.org/windmill boycott.
There's a higher probability that we have another world war, because that's how the international cartel of private central banks stays in power, stays rich, and enslaves the world. 111 years ago, on December 23rd, 1913, is when the United States' third private central bank was created, the Federal Reserve. And the Federal Reserve is not a federal entity. It is completely separate from the government altogether. And the Federal Reserve has no reserves. It doesn't reserve anything. It is a private central bank that is part of an international cartel of private central banks that manufacture wars and kill anyone who tries to dismantle or undermine them. Check it out. Private central banks, like the Federal Reserve, have been starting wars to force their banking systems onto other nations for centuries. And up until recently, we had no way to escape their corrupt, rigged fiat currency pyramid scheme. Now we do with Bitcoin. And Bitcoin is ushering in a bloodless revolution at a much faster pace than many of us who have been in crypto have thought possible. And just to illustrate how crucial the next decade will be in terms of replacing the traditional global financial system with an open, decentralized, transparent, immutable one, let's learn about how we got here in the first place. How we got to this point in modern times, where we do not learn about money in school, where we are told lies about history, where we have almost no time to do anything besides work, because we constantly have hardly any money or freedom, and how it was all by design. Hello, I'm Crypto Casey, and in this extremely important video, we are going to explore a timeline of events from an article called All Banks Are Bankers' Wars by Michael Rivero that have led to what is happening now. The orchestrated systematic destruction of the world as we know it by globalists and private central banks, starting with the American Revolution. Let's hit it. The American Revolution was primarily inspired by King George III's Currency Act, which forced colonists to conduct business using only printed banknotes borrowed from the Bank of England, a private central bank, at a costly interest rate. And what most people don't know is that the colonies had created their own money called the colonial scrip, and it was interest-free, wealth-based money issued by the colonies themselves. Here's a famous quote from Benjamin Franklin describing how it worked. That is simple. In our colonies, we issue our own money. It is called colonial scrip. We issue it in proper proportion to the demands of trade and industry to make the products pass easily from the producers to the consumers. In this manner, creating for ourselves our own paper money, we control its purchasing power and we have no interest to pay. Simple enough, right? And it worked great from when it was created in 1750 until 1764, when the Bank of England, a private central bank, and their bought and paid for king made it illegal. Here's another quote from Benjamin Franklin following the Currency Act. The colonies would gladly have borne the little tax on tea and other matters had it not been that England took away from the colonies their money, which created unemployment and dissatisfaction. The inability of colonists to get power to issue their own money permanently out of the hands of King George III and the international bankers was the prime reason for the Revolutionary War. Very interesting. So after the Revolutionary War, the founders and first government of the United States actually took steps to try to prevent another private central bank from interfering with their new country and its citizens. And this is crazy, check it out. Here's an important telling quote from Thomas Jefferson, basically predicting our current situation hundreds of years beforehand. If the American people ever allow private banks to control the issue of their currency, first by inflation, then by deflation, the banks will deprive the people of all property until their children wake up homeless on the continent their fathers conquered. The issuing power should be taken from the banks and restored to the people, to whom it properly belongs. And here we are, lots of people not owning property, a home, or hardly anything. Here's another quote by John Adams in a letter to Thomas Jefferson. All the perplexities, confusion, and distresses in America arise not from defects in the Constitution or Confederation, nor for the want of honor or virtue, as much from downright ignorance of the nature of coin, credit, and circulation. And this right here is why this channel exists, to share educational videos to spread awareness about how the current traditional financial system works and alternatives like Bitcoin and other open, decentralized, immutable, blockchain-based financial systems to build a better world together. I mean, here's a quote directly from the governor of the Bank of England between 1920 in 1944, Montagu Norman, addressing the United States Bank with the same exact blueprint and game plan the current private central bankers use today. Check it out. Capital must protect itself in every way possible, both by combination and legislation. Debts must be collected, mortgages foreclosed as rapidly as possible. When through process of law, the common people lose their homes, they will become more docile and more easily governed through the strong arm of the government applied by a central power of wealth under leading financiers. These truths are well known among our principal men, who are now engaged in forming an imperialism to govern the world. By dividing the voter through the political party system, we can get them to expend their energies in fighting for questions of no importance. It is thus by discreet action we can secure for ourselves that which has been so well planned and so successfully accomplished. And here we are. We have never been more divided through the political party system, wasting our energy fighting with each other about things they deliberately put in mainstream media to distract us, letting them rob us blind, enslave us, and commit the most egregious crimes against humanity. History is not only rhyming, it's nearly repeating itself. How is it that the United States was founded with the intention of keeping private central bankers out of the government, yet here we are, back to where we started? Well, it's very simple. Bankers are dedicated to schemes of acquiring our wealth, and they know how easy it is to corrupt a nation's leaders. Mayor Amschel Rothschild, the founder of the Rothschild banking dynasty, who is referred to as the founding father of international finance, said this famous quote: "Let me issue and control a nation's money, and I care not who makes the laws." One of Rothschild's chief supporters was Alexander Hamilton, who had actually married into the Rothschild family. And through his relationship with Hamilton, they were successful in setting up a private central bank called the First Bank of the United States as a way to assist the post-Revolutionary War economy, which effectively gave the Rothschilds control over the United States money supply. The private central bank was founded in 1791, and by the end of its 20-year charter, the United States was in ruins, all while the bankers flourished. So when Congress refused to renew the charter because of its utter failure, and instead intended to go back to the state-issued value-based currency where people paid no interest at all to bankers, the head of the private central bank, Nathan Mayer Rothschild, threatened the U.S. government with a war. Congress held their position to not renew the charter, and then Rothschild tried to force British Prime Minister, at the time Spencer Percival, to start a war with the U.S. and take the colonies back. And when he refused to go to war, he was assassinated. In fact, he was the only British Prime Minister to be assassinated in office. Wild. So naturally, his replacement, Robert Banks Jenkins, was fully supportive of a war, and Rothschild financed it at virtually no interest. This was the War of 1812, and the goal was to recolonize the US, or put the US into such debt that they would be forced to accept a new private central bank, which is unfortunately what ended up happening. So even though the United States won the war, Congress was forced to grant a new charter for another private central bank that issued public currency and loans with interest. And it was called the Second Bank of the United States. And like clockwork, this private central bank brought the United States back into ruins, yet again with tons of debt, unemployment, and poverty. That is until Andrew Jackson came along, campaigning for president with the slogan, "Jackson and no bank." Jackson became president and blocked the renewal of the charter for the Second Bank of the United States with this famous quote: "Gentlemen, I too have been a close observer of the doings of the Bank of the United States. I've had men watching you for a long time, and am convinced that you have used the funds of the bank to speculate in the breadstuffs of the country. When you won, you divided the profits amongst you. And when you lost, you charged it to the bank. You tell me that if I take the deposits from the bank and annul its charter, I shall ruin 10,000 families? That may be true, gentlemen, but that is your sin. Should I let you go on, you will ruin 50,000 families. And that would be my sin. You are a den of vipers and thieves. I have determined to rout you out. And by the eternal, I will rout you out." And he did. And not only that, he also routed out all of the national debt. Andrew Jackson was the only president of the United States to actually pay off all of the national debt. Then, surprise, surprise, an assassination attempt was made on Jackson, where fortunately for him, both pistols the attacker was wielding failed to fire. Crazy. So when the Second Bank of the United States lost its charter, it continued to operate as a regular bank and failed after about 5 years. Now, after Andrew Jackson, President Zachary Taylor came into office, and he also opposed the creation of a new private central bank, stating, "The idea of a national bank is dead, and will not be revived in my time. Then, oddly enough, after eating a bowl of cherries and milk, he died, rumored to have been poisoned. Next up, President James Buchanan was in office. He also opposed a private central bank charter, set limits on banks issuing more loans than they had actual funds, and then he was also poisoned. But he actually survived while the other 38 people at the dinner died. Wow. Which brings us to the next war started by the bankers, the Civil War. That's right. When the Confederacy seceded from the United States, private central banks offered to fund President Abraham Lincoln's efforts to bring the South back into the Union at 30% interest. Lincoln responded by saying he would not free slaves by enslaving people to the bankers, and he used his presidential authority to issue a new government interest-free currency called the greenback. And so the bankers retaliated by sending a letter to every bank in the U.S. urging them to fund the mainstream media at the time, newspapers, to oppose Lincoln's greenbacks. A quote from Lincoln says, "I have two great enemies, the Southern army in front of me and the bankers in the rear. Of the two, the one at my rear is my greatest foe." And check this out. The bankers were urging Europe to support the Confederacy to defeat Lincoln's Union, where France and Britain were actually considering attacking the United States to help the Confederacy. However, Russia prevented them from doing so. Tsar Alexander II had just ended serfdom and had a state bank similar to the one the U.S. was originally founded on, and he authorized Russian aid to Lincoln. Then, surprise, surprise, like the reoccurring pattern goes, multiple assassination attempts were made on him in 1866, 1879, and 1880 until a successful one was made in 1881. And after the Union won the war, Lincoln announced that he would continue issuing greenbacks. And then he was assassinated. And after he was killed, greenbacks were pulled from circulation and the U.S. was forced to go back to private central banknotes with interest. Insane. Next up, we have President James Garfield, who was elected in 1880, who was in support of government-controlled money, and he was shot in 1881 and died a few days later. Then in 1896, President William McKinley was elected and favored gold-backed currencies, and he was shot in 1901 and died a few days later. Which brings us to 1910, when six of America's richest men had a secret meeting organized by J.P. Morgan on his property on Jekyll Island, where the idea for the United States' third private central bank was born. And side note, there's a conspiracy that there were three men that stood in J.P. Morgan's way of creating it: John Astor, Isidore Strauss, and Benjamin Guggenheim, that all happened to be on J.P. Morgan's boat, the Titanic, when it sank. Did big private central bankers sink the boat on purpose and get an insurance payout after it sank? Well, yes, J.P. Morgan got paid by the insurance company when his boat sank. Let me know what you think happened with the Titanic in the comments below. All right, now we are getting into the part of the timeline that is most relevant to us today. First, real quick, now is a great time to get familiar with the next generation of banking and finance to exit the corrupt, rigged, traditional financial system by getting a free Uphold account. It only takes like 90 seconds to set up, and as crazy as it sounds, Uphold provides us with a way safer and better option for storing our US dollars, our fiat currency, than banks, and trading crypto than exchanges. Check it out. When we put our hard-earned US dollars or crypto in Uphold, it's actually there, it stays there, and it's 100% backed. When we put our money in a bank or crypto exchange, they don't keep it there, they lend it out. Uphold publicly lists and updates in real time every 30 seconds their balance sheets for anyone to see at any time on their website without an account. Definitely not the case with banks or exchanges. Uphold is one of the first major crypto platforms to offer US dollar interest accounts to US users that are FDIC insured up to $2.5 million. Many banks don't offer interest and only insure up to $250K. And instead of having separate liquidity and token prices like most exchanges, Uphold is actually connected to over 30 underlying exchanges, which gives us the best prices possible and more liquidity when trading crypto, all seamlessly without having to transfer funds between banks and crypto exchanges. It's free to sign up, so scroll down and use link below to access Uphold's correct and official site and redeem any special offers they have for us. Okay, after the Titanic sank with potentially the only guys standing in the way of the creation of the United States' third private central bank in 1912, 1 year later, the third private central bank of the United States was created over the Christmas holiday in 1913. While Congress members who opposed it were at home. This was 111 years ago now, on December 23rd. And in order to push it through, the bankers promised President Woodrow Wilson generous campaign contributions if he signed the act, which he did. And they decided to name the bank the Federal Reserve, to make it seem like a quasi-governmental entity when it's actually not a government entity at all. It's not federal. It has no reserves. It's a pyramid scheme, private central bank. And another fun fact, is that it's exempt from all taxation except property tax. Brilliant. And if you don't believe me, here's a video of former chairman of the Federal Reserve, Alan Greenspan, explaining how it's a private entity that doesn't answer to any government authority.
What is the proper relationship? What should be the proper relationship between a chairman of the Fed and a president of the United States?
Well, first of all, the Federal Reserve is an independent agency, and that means basically that there is no other agency of government which can overrule actions that we take. So long as that is in place and there is no evidence that the administration or the Congress or anybody else is requesting that we do things other than what we think is the appropriate thing, then what the relationships are don't frankly matter. And I've had a very good relation.
There you have it. And not even 7 months after the Federal Reserve was created, guess what happened? World War I in 1914. Mind you, there was no such thing as a world war before that. And a few years after that, in 1919, President Woodrow Wilson said this: "I am a most unhappy man. I have unwittingly ruined my country. A great industrial nation is now controlled by its system of credit. We are no longer a government by free opinion, no longer a government by conviction and the vote of the majority, but a government by the opinion and duress of a small group of dominant men." Sad. So, World War I started between Austria-Hungary and Serbia with the assassination of Archduke Ferdinand. However, media focus quickly shifted to Germany, a big economic threat to Great Britain. So even though Germany didn't even start the war, following the Treaty of Versailles, they were forced to pay the war costs to their own private central bank. Germany had gone into massive debt to pay for the war, massive inflation followed, and the Germans were trapped in endless debt to the private central bank. So when Hitler came into power, his first financial move was what we've seen already throughout history, shifting the country to their own state-issued value-based currency, where they did not have to borrow money from private central banks at interest. And guess what happened? Germany's economy quickly turned around and started flourishing. And media called it the German miracle. So once again, Germany became a threat to Great Britain, and their state-issued monetary system was also a threat to private central banks. And I think we're all starting to realize what happens when private central banks are threatened. Wars are waged and people are killed. All right, so towards the end of World War II in 1944, the world's major economic powers met at a luxury resort in New Hampshire called Bretton Woods, where they created the Bretton Woods Agreement for International Finance. And ultimately, this caused the British pound to lose its status as the world's reserve currency to the US dollar and forced other nations to tie their currencies to US dollar under two conditions. One, the Federal Reserve would not overprint US dollars as a means to steal goods and services from other countries in exchange for devaluing the currency, like an imperial tax. And two, US dollars would always be convertible to gold at $35 per ounce. And obviously, both of those conditions were never kept because the Federal Reserve is a private central bank that doesn't have to answer to the US government or any other governing body. Amazing. Moving right along our timeline here, next we've got President John F. Kennedy. He understood the private central bank's agenda and wrote and signed Executive Order 11110 that ordered the US Treasury to issue a new government-backed currency called the United States Note. They were created by the US government, backed by the silver stockpiles held by the US government. About $4.5 billion went into public circulation. 5 months later, Kennedy was assassinated, and all of the United States notes were pulled from circulation and destroyed. Great. Listen up, here's something important to note about Kennedy's Executive Order 11110. It's actually still in effect. However, no president has been brave enough to touch it since. Will President Trump? Is that one of the reasons an assassination attempt was made on him during his campaign? Let me know what you guys think in the comments below. Back to the Fed not upholding Bretton Woods Agreement. Eventually, other countries started noticing the large piles of US dollars they were accumulating in exchange for real goods and services. Like in the case of France, wine and cheese. Countries around the world started exercising their option under the Bretton Woods Agreement to exchange the paper notes for gold. However, since the Federal Reserve was overprinting money, the US government didn't have enough gold to redeem all the requests. So by 1966, an estimated $14 billion was held by foreign banks, while the US government only had about $3.2 billion worth of gold. So President Richard Nixon had to temporarily suspend the convertibility of US dollars to gold, which obviously became permanent and ultimately ended the Bretton Woods Agreement in 1971. And side note, interestingly enough, this was the same year the same year that the World Economic Forum was founded. It was initially called the European Management Forum, with the goal of introducing European business to American management practices. Sheer coincidence? Or orchestrated by private central bankers looking to consolidate power? Let me know what you think in the comments below. So once it became obvious that the US didn't have enough gold reserves to back its currency, faith in the United States' ability to pay off its debts decreased. And to combat this, Richard Nixon started the environmental movement with the EPA, which effectively allowed the government to use public lands as collateral on national debt under the guise it was being protected and kept pristine. So eventually about 25% of the United States land had been seized by the government and pledged to foreign countries as collateral. And with land in short supply, the US government made deals with the world's largest oil producing countries, where in exchange for only selling their oil for US dollars, the US would guarantee military protection for them. This is when the petrodollar system was born. So the US started effectively backing the US dollar with oil, other foreign countries' oil. Remarkable, isn't it? It's no wonder after the Desert Storm conflict, when Iraq wanted their rights to sell oil in euros instead of US dollars in the early 2000s, that the US reinvaded Iraq under the guise that Saddam Hussein had nuclear weapons he was going to use, when in reality, they did it just to get Iraq's oil transactions back to US dollars. And when Libya announced they were only going to sell their oil for their state-owned value-based trade currency, the gold dinar, the US invaded Libya, killed their leader, imposed a private central bank, and put Libya's oil back on the market for US dollars only. And some of the Hillary Clinton emails released confirmed that the real reason the US invaded Libya was to counteract the threat of the gold dinar becoming a rival to the US dollar and petrodollar system. So, what can we glean from history to piece together what may actually be going on and who stands to benefit from both the process and the outcome? Well, as the cycle goes, private banks issue currencies with interest, which forces countries and their people into more and more debt. Once the people and the government stop borrowing, wars are waged that force everyone into more debt to pay for the wars. After that, countries and people need to borrow more to rebuild. And when it's all said and done, everything is about the same except for more dead people. And the process repeats. So in the current situation, World War III will be an attempt to force the world onto a private central bank US dollar digital currency that is controlled by private central powers like the World Economic Forum, where they can dictate what we can and cannot buy, the amount of goods we can buy, and if we can buy anything at all. So is there hope for us? Do we stand a chance at rebuilding a better world together from the ashes of a more than likely extremely destructive world war? It's possible. Things are much different now with the internet, access to information, independent journalism, people becoming curious, looking for answers, and spreading awareness. So what can we do? We can be aware, talk about it with friends, family, and other people to spread awareness, share content like this online, educate as many people as possible. And we need to be prepared to weather a potential storm of capital controls, where countries start to restrict money flowing from their countries so they can continue using their private central bank currencies to enslave and control people. It will probably become harder to convert our fiat into hard assets like gold, Bitcoin, and similar. So it's more important than ever to understand how and why Bitcoin and blockchain technology offers a better alternative solution to private central banks that is not controlled by a single person, business, government, authority, or entity, rather by the very essence of our universe, with mathematics, physics, and science. And when we do choose to invest in Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies, it's important to understand that we do not actually own or control it until we have transferred it from exchanges to our very own cold storage hardware wallets. So listen up. Any Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies you're accumulating over the long term, make sure you're transferring it off of exchanges to hold securely on multiple hardware wallets. Don't keep all of your eggs in one basket when dealing with this new cutting-edge high-risk technology. Thank you.
Judge Ruckerman, Judge.